and gentlemen, if you could take your seats, we'll get started with the next speaker. Welcome to everyone participating through YAF's virtual pass from around the world. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook and not participating through virtual pass, you can register now to ask Congressman Roy your questions at yaf.org/virtualpass. If you're signed in, you can submit questions through the session to be answered live after the speech. This afternoon, I have the great honor of introducing our next speaker, Representative Chip Roy. Congressman Roy is a former federal prosecutor and top advisor to many prominent Texas elected officials. He previously served as chief of staff to Senator Ted Cruz, as staff director to John Cornyn's leadership office, and as senior counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. In 2014, Congressman Roy became the first assistant attorney general in Texas under Ken Paxton, and served as a senior advisor to then-Governor Rick Perry. Additionally, the congressman also spent numerous years in the private sector, getting experience as an investment banking analyst, a technology consultant, a counsel in the oil and gas industry, and as vice president of strategy for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Congressman Roy is a true conservative committed to restoring healthcare freedom, defending the sanctity of human life, supporting our military, protecting our borders, and reducing federal spending to promote freedom for Americans. His dedication to conservative values is admirable, especially given that recently he was the only representative present to prevent a unanimous consent for a disaster aid bill, choosing instead to bring attention to much needed funding required along the border to manage and combat the surge of migrants. He was heavily criticized for keeping Congress in session until 4 a.m., to which he rightfully snapped back with, quote, "The people mad are the jet fume sniffing, cocktail sipping, swamp creatures who don't want to hashtag do what we said they would." So please join me in giving a warm welcome to a man who does what he says he will, Representative Chip Roy.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Well, I really appreciate that great introduction. The problem with having had so many interesting jobs is just demonstrates that I can't really keep a job. Just kind of hopping from one job to the next. I'll say I was really excited. I was out there in the hallway and I was talking to the great YIF staff, and it goes broke after the last speaker, and everybody was running out, like running right at me. And I thought, man, I've really arrived. And I looked behind me and saw that table of Ben Shapiro pictures, and I was like, I guess I haven't arrived. But I really am thankful to be here. I did, in fact, grow up as a child of Reagan. So in the era of 1980s, I was 8 years old when President Reagan first ran for president in 1980, or when he ran for president in the general election in 1980, obviously he ran in 76. And so I grew up under the Reagan era. So it's really great to come out here, come to the ranch and be a part of this this experience. In fact, the first election I ever voted in was Reagan in 1980, although I was only in third grade, unless you think I'm older than I look. It was in the third grade weekly reader poll. I don't know if they still do that sort of thing anymore, but we had an election. In my class, Reagan won 25-3-1, and it was a very conservative area. But so I remember Reagan well, but it's an honor to be here. The president obviously inspires us a great deal, and I was honored to have the introduction I just had about saying I would do what I said I would do. In part, that grew out of my watching President Reagan do what he did. And he did what he said he would do when he got to the White House. And many of you all know that the president had many great speeches, but probably the one he's most known for is his Time for Choosing speech. If you don't know his Time for Choosing speech, I suggest you watch it. It's a great speech. Gave it in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was running against then incumbent President Lyndon Johnson. And in that speech, the president the future president, Ronald Reagan said, quote, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free." And I was thinking about that quote as we were coming out here, because Reagan, of course, was making the point that the Goldwater-Johnson race was much bigger than just a choice between those two candidates. He went on to say that you and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We will preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we will sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. I wish people spoke like that today. But that spells the battle that we're in and remain in. Because the truth is, the point that President Reagan was really making is that this is not about 1964 uniquely, right? That is now 55 years ago. I'm 46. I came in on the back end of that. That was 55 years ago. But it wasn't a bit unique to that era. He knew that. He knew that being an American, by its nature, is a state of choosing. So when they say it's a time for choosing, it wasn't about 1964. It was a time for choosing. It's about being an American. It's who we are. It's who we've always been. And because of this, it means that every American has always lived in a time for choosing, including you, including my generation, including your parents, your grandparents, and all of our forefathers. Now, stay with me for a minute, because I think this matters. It was a choice when the explorers set out to grab a new world. It was a choice when Jamestown was settled in Virginia, when the pilgrims went to Plymouth Rock. And you gloss over those things as 2 pages in a history book, but think about that life. Think about getting on a boat in 3 months across a journey and coming across the Atlantic Ocean and then coming to a wild area and settling it and then having to figure out whether you're going to stay the cause. It was a choice when shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, when Americans under the crown took up arms against the crown. Imagine doing that today, that choice. It was a choice when the men who signed the Declaration of Independence pledged their lives, their fortunes, and sacred honor, and that actually meant something. They were essentially signing their death warrant. It was a choice when the founders chose a republic. It was a choice when Washington chose to turn down being a king. It was a choice when the Tennesseans joined the Texans in San Antonio and Bexar County to stand up on the wall in defense of liberty at the Alamo. It was a choice when the South seceded, and it was a choice when the North fought the South to preserve the republic. It was a choice when Lincoln emancipated the slaves. It was a choice when Congress and the people made sure that all could vote regardless of race or sex. It was a choice when America then bled in Europe in World War I, bled again in the Pacific, bled again in Europe in World War II. It was a choice when 75 years ago this month, those men stormed the beaches of Normandy and sat in the cold in Bastogne to defeat Hitler and liberate Jews from the hell of actual concentration camps. Was it not a choice when Rosa Parks told a bus driver to pound sand? Was it not a choice to put a man on the moon? Was it not a choice to fight the march of communism as President Reagan did in the Soviet Union? But first, we were there in Korea, we were there in Vietnam, and in the long Cold War that came to an end under President Reagan's leadership. It was a choice. It was a choice to go back to space even after the space shuttle Challenger exploded. And it was a choice for us to again fight terrorists abroad to keep them away from America in the wake of 9/11, which is now a point in the history books for y'all, but a very real part of our lives. This is your birthright. But the president was right that it's not blood. It's a will. It's a belief. It's a time for choosing every day. And these choices, the seemingly big choices I just went through, they're not actually the real difficult choices that we face every day. Not in the way that President Reagan meant it. Our real difficult choice is whether we will defend freedom and national sovereignty from our own encroachment, our own destruction from within. And I'm not talking about half freedom. I'm not talking about slivers of freedom given to you by government, but honest to goodness, God-given freedom, the kind that comes with hardship and difficulty, not with assured outcomes. That's what freedom is. Rather, the guaranteed opportunity to live, whether struggling or prospering, according to those God-given rights. And I'm not talking about half sovereignty. I'm talking about full sovereignty. We don't want a world in which we allow our nation to blur the lines of our own governance and citizenship with a world that, while benefiting from American exceptionalism, does not embrace it. Yet too often, that's what the left wants us to do. Rather, we want full sovereignty in which we are proud of and defend the American that we know as a nation with common values and a spirit of pride in who we are as a people to the betterment of our own nation and anyone who seeks to come here. The choice President Reagan was referencing was the choice between statism and freedom, tyranny and liberty. In our family life, our economic life, in our daily pursuit of happiness, to quote Thomas Jefferson, if you will, as measured by the relative existence of government in our lives versus a necessary government operating under the Constitution, according to the consent of the governed. Each day we have to make these choices as citizens. They're choices of life. You have to choose how you're going to practice your faith. Choose to raise your children in a community of your choice and according to your faith. Choose to defend your family armed as you feel appropriate, not as how the government feels appropriate. Choose to start a business without having to bow down to the altar of government to give you a license to do it. Be able to put up a lemonade stand. We just had to pass a law in Texas to allow kids to put up a lemonade stand. This is economic liberty. This is the choice that we're talking about. Choosing to say what you want, particularly in academic settings at universities. As elected leaders, our job is to protect the liberty that citizens exercise and with which government has no right to interfere, while defending our nation and our sovereignty as a nation so that we can continue to protect those rights. That is our fundamental purpose. Yet I have to be honest, your parents, my parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents over the last several decades, to be quite honest, has let us down in continuing and perpetuate that fight. Consider the size and scope of government today versus the time of Mr. Reagan's Time for Choosing speech. Ronald Reagan lamented in 1964 spending $17 million more per year than we took in as a government, which is about $140 million in today's dollars. Today, we spend $100 million more than we take in per hour. That's on y'all. That gets passed down to the next generation and the next. $100 million per hour we're racking up in debt. I actually got PolitiFact checked on that because I said it in the Cohen hearing that we had in the Oversight Committee and the House Representatives. I got a mostly true from PolitiFact. That's pretty much the Gospel of Luke from PolitiFact if you get a mostly true. It's $100 million an hour we're racking up in debt. Our debt in 1964 was just over $300 billion. Now, most of that was racked up in World War II, when we essentially saved the world from Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. That would be roughly $3 trillion in today's dollars, $300 billion, over the last 55 years. As you all probably know, the national debt today stands at $22 trillion and counting in the face of a $1 trillion deficit we'll add this year and in the next several years. Does anybody in this room know how long it would take you to count to 22 trillion if you did it one per second, one Mississippi? How long would it take you to count to 22 trillion? 700,000 years. Do the math. Pull up your spreadsheet on your laptop, you're sitting there. But 700,000 years. But it's not just spending, it's not just the debt. Debt is in many ways real, but in many ways abstract. That's why I just tried to give you a way to try to figure out and wrap your head around $22 trillion, because nobody really can. But it does mean, as the President Reagan pointed out in that speech, that government is infinitely bigger and more intrusive into your life, right? It's not just the dollars. It's code for giving government more power. Every single dollar we keep spending is another bureaucrat doing something that interferes with your God-given right to produce for your family and live your life according to the dictates of your conscience for the betterment of your family. And the rights that were protected in the Constitution, but were really spelled out as we understood it in the Declaration. Rules get promulgated in the name of environmental protection that take away the ability of a family farm to use that land that's been in the family for generations. Taxes get placed to make people have to sell their businesses or land when they inherit it so that a family can't pass it down from one generation to the next has been the history of our birthright in this country. In the false name of equality, Our fundamental rights are trampled where a private Christian school may be told that no matter what your beliefs are, you must hire someone to teach your kids that do not share your values, or that a boy can run against girls in a track meet because the boy wakes up and decides to call himself a girl. This is the state of freedom in the United States today. But it's because the people have allowed it to happen. It is why your great calling is to stand up and preserve the very liberties that for generations they've been trying to protect in our Constitution, but we've been allowing to wither away. Since 1964, we've added almost 500,000 bureaucrats to government agencies since the president gave that speech. But it's not just spending, it's not just debt, it's a failure to do even the most fundamental tasks of government, like securing the border of the United States and ensuring we know who comes in and out of our country and allow it to be done safely for the migrants who seek to come here. Many do not know that we invite approximately 1.2 million people a year to come into the United States legally. 1.2 million. About 1 in 7 residents in the United States are foreign-born. 1 in 7. Which is close to an historical high of about 14%, up from an historical low of about 5% in 1970, about the time I was born. My point of saying that is not to say that one of those numbers is good or bad. It's to say that we have never really been more welcoming of immigrants as a nation, legally, than we are today. Yet the government is utterly failing to secure our border in a post-9/11 world, in a world where cartels have operational control of the southern border of the United States. Look, this has been front and center of everything that I've been doing. We were just talking about some votes that I demanded on the floor of the House of Representatives. I'll talk about that more in a minute and hopefully get into it more in questions and answers. But this is the central issue that we're dealing with right now in Washington, is whether or not we are going to be a sovereign nation and secure our border. Whether or not we're going to have a serious question about whether or not we want to increase the numbers of people we allow, decrease the numbers of people we allow. But regardless of what you think, whether we're going to actually do our job to secure the border. Let me tell you what it's like in South Texas. Now, I know California is a border state, and you guys come from all over the country, but South Texas right now is an unbelievable state of control by cartels, choosing who gets to come across the border and making tons of money moving people. You guys have seen movies or seen stories, and you see that, well, they're making all their money moving drugs and narcotics. But the truth is, the Reynosa faction of the Gulf Cartel, which operates in Tamaulipas, and in that portion of Mexico, right across from Brownsville and McAllen, across the border from Texas, is going to make several hundred million dollars this year moving human beings. The Cartel del Noreste of Los Zetas, which operates closer to Laredo and a little bit farther up, the Sinaloa Cartel, if you add all of that up and everything, reports indicated that they made about $2 billion moving people in 2018. Human beings. When I went down to McAllen in January, and it's much worse today than it was then, and I sat under the bridge and I met with migrants who were literally walking across, coming across and asking, where is Border Patrol? They're not running from Border Patrol, they're seeking Border Patrol because they know they're gonna get taken, processed, and released into the United States. Met with Border Patrol, and the estimates in that one sector was that 400,000 people would be coming through that one sector this year. 200,000 would be apprehended, 200,000 would not. But of the ones that were apprehended, 90% would be captured and then released into our country. We talked to some boys there who had slept the night in a park in Reynosa the last 5 nights before I talked to them at the border, having paid the cartels to come across the river. Then they knew that they were going to be on the hook to have to pay the cartels money once they're here. There were 54 people found in a stash house in Houston, Texas, paying ransom to cartels because the cartels have them on the hook once they're here. I don't want to get into it, but you've read the news accounts and seen the stories of the little girls and the women that are abused on the journey coming through Mexico. This is what the greatest nation in the history of the world is allowing to happen on our watch. I can get into the costs, I can get into what's broken about it, but the fact of the matter is, Border Patrol and ICE are overwhelmed. And people shine the spotlight on some condition. with all due respect to my Democrat colleagues who go around talking about children in cages, they go down to the facilities, they walk in and they see Border Patrol overwhelmed with literally tens of thousands flowing across our border. 144,000 apprehended in May. That is an extraordinary number, like we've never seen before. And they fill the processing centers, and they don't have any place to put them. And the Democrats will say, well, you're doing a great job. You're doing what you need to do. You're separating dads who are fake dads from that are using kids to come across the river. And then they walk across the street, and they go to a microphone in front of a TV, and then they say, kids in cages. And they politicize it. These are human beings. Like everyone in this room, we know we want to, as a matter of our faith or as a matter of our common decency, take care of human beings who are seeking a better life. But we cannot allow the rule of law to be tossed overboard and our borders to be turned open so that MS-13 and dangerous gangs can reach farther into Texas as is happening now and can spread through the country as is happening now. And for cartels to gain dangerous influence and control of our border as is happening now. All of that is happening as we speak. Today, another 4,000 or 5,000 people will flow across our southern border. And those cartels will make an additional tens of millions of dollars moving people across. It is an obligation as a sovereign nation to deal with that problem. So in the last several weeks, I and a few of my colleagues were trying to make the point that at a bare minimum, our Democrat colleagues should at least agree to provide the humanitarian funding and relief to deal with the crisis at the border. That President Trump and his administrators had sent up a $4.5 billion ask to say, let's take care of everybody. And our Democrat colleagues wouldn't do it. So 2 weeks ago, I went to the floor and had the audacity to demand the yays and nays on votes. Now, if you don't know what that means, if you've watched Schoolhouse Rocks and you figure out how a bill becomes law, right? I'm sure somewhere in there they talked about that bills become laws because you have two people on the floor of the House of Representatives who agree by unanimous consent or by voice vote to move a bill off the floor, right? I'm sure that's what they said. No, what you were taught and what everybody's taught is you vote. That you're electing representatives. I represent about 730,000 people. I'm supposed to vote. So I went to the floor of the House of Representatives and I had the audacity to demand the yays and nays. That means we were going to have a series of votes. So instead of having maybe 10 votes on a handful of matters, we had about 80 votes. I was not Mr. Popular in the D.C. cocktail circuit. Because what that meant was everybody was going to have to stay there all night into the wee hours of the morning voting. This is not the last time that this is going to happen. Because my belief is we should vote. My belief is we should do our basic job and go before the people and demonstrate what we believe and actually have a vote on the important issues of the day. And then, oh, by the way, we should actually do our job and provide the funding to take care of people and then secure the border to prevent future flow from coming across the border. But why do I bring all that up? It's a little bit in the weeds and we can talk through some questions. What I want you to understand is the blowback I got from Washington establishment was enormous. Said I was grandstanding. They said that I didn't have a strategy. They said that this was all for show. They said that this was going to destroy the ability of Republicans to paint Democrats as partisans instead of bipartisans because we were going to have more votes and their batting averages might move up on votes. I'm not making this up. The day after we had the votes, I was in a lunch or in a meeting with Republicans, and that's what I was told. Is that your all's view of democracy? Is that how you think the decisions should be made? Should they be made through a political, constant campaigning lens? You know what I was told by certain of the leaders in Washington? I'm afraid that you're going to mess up our shirts and skins battles. They view it as shirts and skins, Republicans versus Democrats. I view this as protecting American sovereignty and making sure the migrants who seek to come here can do through a system that actually works. And I think that's what the founders wanted, and I think that's what you want, I think that's what the American people want. But what you have to understand is that's not what the Washington established order wants. And that's what we're up against. For the most part, leadership in Washington either does not care about these problems or refuses to do anything about them. They give big press conferences about spending. They'll talk about a balanced budget amendment. They'll give big speeches about border security or about health care or having a strong military, but they don't stand up when the fight matters. When I was Senator Cruz's chief of staff in 2013, most of y'all were probably too young to remember or maybe just remember, but when Senator Cruz was first in the Senate, Obamacare was just getting implemented. We believed it was going to drive up the cost of Obamacare. So Senator Cruz fairly famously went to the floor of the Senate and had an all-night-long filibuster and basically took the floor of the Senate for almost 24 hours, about 23 hours, and spoke. And we stayed up all night, and we spoke. And Senator Mike Lee joined, and other senators, and Senator Paul, and we spoke all through the night and somewhat captured the imagination of the American people for a while on purpose. But again, all of the decision-makers, the powers that be in Washington, pushed back and said this was all for Senator Cruz and all for show. They weren't with Senator Cruz and Senator Lee and me and our staff when we were praying in a room off the floor right before it, praying for guidance in order to try to preserve the Republic and preserve healthcare freedom for the American people. But they try to characterize it all as a show. This is what we're seeing in Washington. This is what we're seeing as the battle. In what universe is shirts versus skins a governing philosophy? And in what universe is that what you want? The other side, the side committed to statism and liberalism, are unrelenting in what they want, and it will undermine your futures and the future of our nation. When John Hickenlooper, a Democrat, was booed in San Francisco for simply denouncing socialism. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez goes out and talks about, quote, capitalism is irredeemable. When the New York Times op-ed says, quote, American capitalism isn't working. In a pharmaceutical hearing for a company called Gilead, which produces Truvada, which helps people with AIDS live longer, we had a hearing. And in that hearing, we were talking about some of the complex issues involving patents and stuff that's all arcane. But my colleagues on the other side of the aisle started attacking them for making money. Well, I can tell you this. 8 years ago, when I had a two-year-old son and a three-month-old daughter, and I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancer, and I was able to take a trial drug that a pharmaceutical company manufactured, and it saved my life. I hope those people are rolling in money. And I hope they're taking that money and distributing it around the world so that more and more people can get drugs and be able to save the lives of more people around the world. But that whole idea that you should make money in this country producing whatever you produce, whether it's medicine or computers, iPhones or cars, somehow that is a negative, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are on full force, full attack, saying that we should not have that. Go look at some of the statements that were made in that hearing, undermining and attacking profit and capitalism. This is not to say, by the way, that we shouldn't change patent laws or make some reforms to make sure that there's more competition and we can get prices down. We should. But the system is under attack. There's attacks on our sovereignty. The New York Times op-ed, there is nothing wrong with open borders. In a post-9/11 world, there's nothing wrong with open borders. Senator Kamala Harris compared ICE, the part of the DHS responsible for enforcing immigration laws, to the KKK. These are American citizens working for their government to enforce the laws, and that's what she compares it to. AOC claimed border detention centers are concentration camps, as I alluded to before. This is insanity. But this is what's coming at our country and our belief system. And my Democrat colleagues are continuing to drag their feet on giving humanitarian aid to pay for the migrants at the border for political purposes. The left is out for keeps. They've co-opted universities, the media, entertainment, and now increasingly corporate boardrooms. And the popularity of President Trump is rooted in his willingness to challenge those things, to challenge the status quo, to challenge the swamp. But of course, like every president, he will come and go. Senator Cruz will come and go. I will come and go. All of us will come and go. We put our faith in principles, not princes. We put our faith in the people, not in government. Our calling is to stand up and fight for freedom, individual liberty, and our shared conservative values, because if we do not, the freedoms we all enjoy today could be taken away from us, as President Reagan said, within a generation. So what does that mean for y'all? I think most of you are in high school, possibly other times in your life, you're young and probably don't think you have too much power to change things. But the fact of the matter is that's wrong. It was a tireless minority that was able to found this country, right? It doesn't take a majority. Sam Adams said it was, in fact, a tireless minority willing to set brush fires of freedom. If they would have taken a poll in 1775, they wouldn't have said fire shots at Lexington and Concord. They would not have. It took leadership and a small group of people fighting for freedom to get there. The challenge for all those who love liberty, limited government, and freedom is winning hearts and minds. This is what I tell my staff in Washington all the time. How can we show that a system of healthcare centered around actual healthcare, not health insurance, is a vastly better option to provide quality of care than a $32 trillion Medicare for all takeover of healthcare system that my Democrat colleagues prefer? How can we show that a capitalistic system in which the bottom 20% of Americans are shown to rise to the top income brackets within generations is far superior to socialism? You're going to face challenges in college. You know, I'm sure Ben, in a much more humorous conversation than I'm offering today, informed you all of what a lot of the things you're going to face when you get to college campuses. Maybe you're facing it now. Professors and fellow students in the classroom that will be unwilling to even engage, offended at the notion of listening to what you have to say. I'd love to say that it will stop once you leave your collegiate years, but I promise you, airdrop me in the middle of a Republican conference, and I'm going to be criticized for daring to stand up and say we should fight. I have been numerous times in the 5 months that I've been in Congress. Your challenge is to respectfully stand up for what you believe, despite the backlash you might face from your peers. And let me tell you something, they may not like what you have to say, but they will respect you for it in the end. The takeaway here is that sometimes what gets the loudest applause isn't what always is best for the nation, particularly in the 24-hour news cycle and the world of social media and Twitter and Facebook and all of the other mechanisms in which we get information. What is seemingly popular among some, like Medicare for All or federalizing elections or suppressing free speech, isn't what is supported by most people, or even more importantly, what is best for tomorrow. And to defeat bad ideas, we must show people, no matter how difficult the task, that a society based on freedom, individual liberty, and the rule of law is a society where all human beings can flourish. I don't say all of this to be negative or pessimistic or to invoke fear or for some shock and awe value. I say it because it is incumbent upon you. You are here for a reason. You will be the next generation, the next leaders who can stand up to preserve this great experiment for the next generation. The world is riddled with democracies that have gone tyrannical, usurping power and oppressing individuals. It can happen here too if we aren't vigilant. Just a few weeks ago, we celebrated the 75th anniversary of D-Day. I was able to go to the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia. How many of you have seen Saving Private Ryan? All right, a good number given that it came out before you were born. But Saving Private Ryan, you know, it was about trying to find Private Ryan because his brothers had been killed in the initial invasion. Well, Bedford, Virginia is the real life story of that. There were something like 30 of-age males that were taking part in the invasion, and 19 of them were killed, I think, on day one. So they put the National D-Day Memorial there in Bedford, Virginia. Vice President Pence, myself, two of my fellow congressmen were there, and it was extraordinary. Many of you have probably seen or at least are aware of the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers. If you don't, I commend it to you. It tells the true story of Easy Company, 506th Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division, U.S. Army, from D-Day until America took Hitler's nest. These men spent day after day, week after week, month after month, fighting the Nazi regime into oblivion, and they never gave up. They didn't decide to turn around when they were getting pelted with bombs and bullets on the beaches of Normandy, or when they were buried in foxholes sitting in sub-zero, literally, sub-zero temperatures with ballistics going around them in Bastogne, or when their supplies got low and it seemed all too easy just to give up. This is our forefathers. This is our obligation to carry forward. Because then why were they sitting in those foxholes in sub-zero temperatures but for us to carry on that legacy? These men and the families back home keeping our nation running New America, both the reality and the ideal, was worth every bit of effort. Do not allow the politics of party, of shirts and skins, of Washington swamp action, take away our liberty because we don't want to win minds and hearts. President Reagan knew and espoused the values that made this nation great because he believed in America. He went and he knew that he went to Washington knowing that we are a nation of people who choose at all times to do the right thing because it's who we are. But for that to continue, each generation has to grab the mantle. That is your calling. That is why you are here. I appreciate the ability to speak here, and I look forward to taking some questions from y'all.
Hi, I'm Ava Von Lipinski. I go to Beverly Hills High School, but I graduated this year. I'm going to UCLA, which is a pretty liberal school, as most of the UCs. And my question is, can you comment on the radical comparisons people such as Ocasio-Cortez, Kamala Harris, and many other Democrats make when, say, comparing migrant camps to concentration centers?
I can't. Did you say her name was Ava?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, look, you guys see the headlines, you see the news, you see the tweets. You know, I like Alexandria, I like my colleagues just fine, and we get along. We may actually even introduce a bill together to put a lifetime ban on lobbying for members of Congress, try to kind of break the back of the swamp a little bit. So I'm happy to work with anybody on either side of the aisle if it's going to do the right thing. But I do believe that she and some of my colleagues, particularly on the other side of the aisle, are all too prone to sensationalize things for clicks and to use hyperbole in order to try to make some point, however backwards it may be. This concentration camp example is particularly offensive and grotesque. We all know, if you're an actual student of history, what concentration camps look like and the horrors that are associated with those. Clearly her statement was offensive to Jewish population, but you know what? It's offensive to Americans, it's offensive to those who liberated those concentration camps. It's offensive to ICE and Border Patrol, who are working every day with lacking the resources to do their job to secure our border. I don't care if you believe that we should have 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, 10 million people come in every year. I don't care if you believe that we should have mostly open borders. But I tweeted at Alexandria the other day when she was railing on something on Twitter, basically to get her clicks up and to get her 4 million followers, you know, up. And I said, look, if you believe in open borders, say so. If you don't, then let's sit down and figure out what resources we want to give so that our people that we ask to do the job have the resources to do the job. Because I, for one, don't want MS-13 and cartels in my communities, and I don't want somebody who can hurt the United States like happened on 9/11 to come into our communities. So let's get busy doing our job to provide the resources necessary and stop with the hyperbole.
Thank you.
Yep.
Our next question comes from one of our virtual pass attendees. Maxine of Stockton High School wants to know, we know from hard data that conservative principles and policies work, so why does America keep sending liberals to Congress?
Well, I think in part, to some degree, it's a significant part of our kind of gerrymandered districts and the way that we kind of carve up voting in this country. But I also think at the end of the day, the hardest part about being a believer in limited government and in constitutional principles and conservatism, as I think, at least as I define it, is that essentially you believe in freedom, you believe in personal responsibility, and that's not as easy to sell as here's free stuff. If you're selling here's free stuff, that's a lot easier. So if you ask why liberals get elected, then I would say that's the reason why. And this is the age-old problem we have. But at the end of the day, the American people want to achieve. When you all went up to the ranch, a good part of the presentation was about how much he liked to do himself, was it not? Right? Laying the patio stones himself, working on the house himself, cutting trees, using the chainsaws. And that's the American way. And I think that's a part of what is why the American experience has led the world, right? It's personal responsibility and achievement. So I think that at the end of the day, the question is, we just have to do a better job selling how much that makes America greater, lifts all boats, creates opportunity, creates jobs, creates wealth, and creates the kind of prosperity that the American people have done that have liberated the world. Follow the Twitter accounts out there that talk about human flourishing and about how much humanity has changed over the last 200 years. America has led the way. By the way, fossil fuel-driven abundance of energy has led the way. The ability to have power, the ability for hospitals to be backed up with generators and have power instead of doctors using bags to keep babies alive in third world countries, we want to get power around the world. Life expectancies have increased. All of that has been happening as a result of American capitalism and ingenuity. So we just have to do a better job continuing to sell it. That's going to be your all's job. Yes, sir. Are we back and forth? Yeah.
Hi, my name's Taylor Dean. I'm from Scotts Valley High School in California. My question is, what is your thoughts on the prospect of Mexico becoming a safe third country, given that we often say that it's run by the drug cartels? How can we hold those ideas simultaneously, if we do?
Well, that's a great question. And if you don't know the issue very well, the short version is that there are, in international law, there's the ability to have a safe third country where if somebody's seeking asylum, they can await in that safe third country while they're seeking asylum in another country. So in this case, we would be seeking to have an agreement with Mexico in order for that to be the case. And it is a great question, right, as to whether or not Mexico can or should be a safe third country. The fact of the matter is, of course, almost all of those seeking relief from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala and places in Central America are going through Mexico to get to the United States. And I don't begrudge them that. I understand why they might want to come to the United States. But it's important that we have the rule of law. It's important that we do the right thing. And a safe third country is an important option to be able to try to work with Mexico. And in part of this is trying to force Mexico to deal with the fact that cartels have too much influence on the structure of government. I introduced a piece of legislation about 3 months ago to declare certain cartels, the ones I mentioned before, as foreign terrorist organizations. Because in my view, we ought to unleash the tools of our intelligence operations and our military to be able to undermine the cartels that are attacking and undermining our way of life and exploiting human beings for profit. And I think we ought to do that.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Little from Red Oak, Texas.
Excellent.
And one very eye-opening thing to me and other Texans was how many votes Beto actually got in the Cruz and Beto election in Texas. I actually want to know your opinion on why so many cities in Texas have become so liberal, and what can young Texans like me do to help change that?
Well, it's a good question. Much has been made of it. I'm glad you're here proud Texan. And look, much has been made of what's happening with Texas changing, you know, flipping Texas blue. And look, there's some truth to the fact that a lot of people are moving to Texas, right? And that changes Texas. A whole lot of Californians, by the way, are moving to Texas. I had a woman that approached me in the campaign about a year ago, and she came up to me. She wrote me a very nice check and looked at me and she says, "You have got to win because I have got nowhere else to move to and I just moved here last week from California." And that we get that a lot. There are 1,000 people a day moving to Texas. 1,000 people a day, 365,000 people a year move to Texas because Texas jobs are leading the world, because our unemployment rate is so low and there's so much opportunity, because oil and gas and fracking and gas production is driving the energy renaissance that's driving CO2 down while increasing clean energy. So a lot of people move there. I tend to think that the self-selectors, like I just described, they're moving there and they share our values. Another friend who's now a donor that that I've gotten to know, same thing, moved to Texas just a few years ago because he was tired of living in New York under oppressive regulations and oppressive taxes. So people are seeking Texas for a reason. But it's a real issue that we've got to pay attention to. I think there was a little bit of irrational exuberance tied to the performance of Beto. Look, he had $80 million, $80 million, which is an unbelievable amount of money to run a Senate campaign. $4 million they spent on just signs, $4 million on signs. Senator Cruz had about 30 people on staff. Beto had 800 people paid. So there's a lot of factors in all of that. And I think they shot a lot of their energy into that, and they still ran right into the Texas buzzsaw. To answer your question about what you can do, get involved. And I know that's what everybody always says. Get involved on a campaign. I didn't end up here just accidentally. In 2000, I was volunteering on the Bush campaign while I was in law school. Go all the way back to 1993, I was volunteering on George Allen, whose picture's out there in the lobby, on his gubernatorial campaign in Virginia when I was at the University of Virginia. Volunteered on the Bush campaign. I volunteered on John Cornyn's campaign for Senate. Then he asked me to go work in Washington. I got paid, you know, not as well as my colleagues in the private sector to go work on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it was an honor. If you want to do this, you just get involved and you work hard. Talk to your friends. Explain to them why your values matter. Explain to them why our belief system is what produces greatness and opportunity for more people. We're literally continuing to lead the world despite the left's assault on us. Let's be proud of what we believe in. You know, let's be conservative and proud of it and be happy about it, right? Instead of defensive and always on our heels.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Derek Evans from Aurora High School in Nebraska. And my question for you is, like you said before in your speech, how the Republicans want to keep Congress and the House divided, shirts and skins. And throughout history, we've had Republican leaders who say a nation divided cannot stand. Why do they want to keep it divided? And how can we kind of fix that?
I'm really impressed that you're here instead of at the College World Series, which if I were a Nebraska resident, I'd be in Omaha at the College World Series. So I'm really impressed that you are here fighting for conservative principles. Look, I think the answer to that question is simple. It's power. People on both sides of the aisle, both parties, they do it all the time. They succumb to wanting power. I had a guy, we were on a text thread the other day, a bunch of freshman congressmen, and they were giving me grief. There was a block who were fully supportive of what I did in demanding votes last week, and a block that thought that it wasn't the right strategy. The block thought it was not the right strategy. It was giving me some grief. Most of it was good-natured. Sometimes it crosses into a little bit of a, you know, kind of whacking. That's okay. That's what we're there for. And, you know, he basically was saying that when I was talking about the border security, and we'd had the mayor of Uvalde, Texas, come up and do a press conference, and he was talking about his town of 17,000, having to deal with getting overrun with people in their ranches. They can't even have their kids down there anymore because they're getting so many people flooding across their border, car chases, gangs, and things that are attacking. This is just west of San Antonio. And the mayor of Uvalde said that. So I told my freshman colleague, why don't you go talk to the mayor of Uvalde? And he goes, yeah, I'd be happy to. What I'll tell him to is we need to get elected in November of 2020. You mean really that's your answer, right? This is one of my freshman Republican colleagues who said, that's your answer, which is we need to get elected and have a Republican majority in November of 2020. You know my first response to that is? You had the majority for the last 2 years and you blew it. That's my first answer. My second answer is I've heard that nonstop for 15 years that we just need to get the majority. You know what the second response will be once we get the majority, besides failing to put together a good bill, is they'll say, well, the Senate doesn't have 60 votes. You know how many times I've heard that? Well, we can't pass that because the Senate doesn't have 60. You know what my answer is? Lead, fight, put forward something that will get the American people behind you. Go out and give a message that will get people to be inspired and to win minds and hearts. Give people a reason to get behind you instead of just looking to get power so you can be the chairman of some committee. I don't care about all that. I want the border of the United States to be secure. I want people who come here to have a safe passage under our rule of law. I want to have low taxes, I want to have balanced budget, I want to have a military that has a clear mission but used sparingly. I want to have healthcare freedom, and then I want the federal government to get the hell out of our way. And that's what I think we ought to stand up and say.
Thank you.
We have another virtual pass question from Kim in San Antonio. What would you say to people who argue that we need border security, but we don't need an actual wall? Is this a cohesive position to hold?
I think I caught all of that because, so you're saying, what do I say to people who say we don't need border security?
We need border security, but not a wall.
Oh, got it, sorry. I would say go to any place along the border, open your eyes, and then come back and talk to me. Because go to Southern California where there's triple layer fencing that was put in place after the mid-1990s when apprehensions in Southern California were closer to 500,000 and now they're closer to 30 or 40,000. Go to Brownsville and McAllen, Texas, where 400,000 people, as I said earlier, will be coming across the border in McAllen when 15 or 20 miles down the road in Brownsville, that number is a fraction. What's the difference? Brownsville has fencing. McAllen has less fencing. It works. It's worked for all of history. I don't know why it's some sort of magic thought that having a fence is a barrier to people crossing a line you wish they don't cross. That is nothing new. We've been doing it for years. Now, do we need a fence from Brownsville to San Diego? I don't know. But can we at least just get a fence up and parts of it? Can we at least give the resources and the cameras and the technology necessary to secure the border? I was down in Laredo, Texas last September with a Border Patrol agent. He was a young guy, and he was saying, hey, I go down here. It's 11 o'clock at night. I'm right on the border in thick cane. I cannot see the river. There's only 2 miles of the, I think, 70-mile sector where I can drive a car along the river. I've got a radio that doesn't work. I've got a cell that usually doesn't have a signal. And I'm down here by myself, and the cartels have operational control of the border. Anybody here want to sign up for that job? I mean, this is what we're asking our Border Patrol agents to do. So I would say to those individuals who say that, go to the border. Go look at the river. Go look at the cane. Go look at where there's no fence. And then go look at the eyes of one of the little girls that I see crossing the river and say, I think it's a good thing that that person just crossed through Mexico with the cartels moving them through with Lord knows what happening to them. Because we don't do our job. I think it's unconscionable. I think we ought to change it. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. My name is Lindsay Allen, and I just graduated from Frontier Charter School. And I was wondering, with the increased polarization between Democrats and Republicans, if you think there's any hope for a bipartisan middle ground, and what needs to be done on both sides to be able to do that?
Well, it's a good question, and it's always an interesting question, and I think that my personal belief is that the path to bipartisanship is force people to operate within a budget. I really think it's that simple. In no other part of the world, at least in America, right? I mean, some other countries do this too, but in no other realm of life, businesses, families, do you typically operate where, well, we don't have enough money, what the hell, let's just spend some more money. Right? You typically don't do that, right? You got to figure out how to get a bank, you got to get a loan, you got to have collateral, you got to spend within your means. We don't do that. We have about $3.5 trillion of income. We're going to spend about $4.5 trillion. And they don't seem to care. What happens? I circulated a letter in April saying we should have held to the caps. If you don't know what the caps are, in 2011, when Barack Obama got our spending all the way up to deficits of $1.3 trillion, the Tea Party was formed, there was a backlash, Republicans came back in 2010, and then there was an effort, although it took some fighting, trust me, to get across the line caps, to hold spending in check. Nowhere near balance yet, by the way, just hold, like put some caps in. And if you don't meet it and you don't pass a budget, automatic cuts will kick in across the board. It was blunt, it was harmful in some areas, defense included. So why do we do that? Well, to try to hold spending. Well, ever since then, it worked for a few years. Deficits dropped to about $400 billion. Only in Washington is that somehow a great victory. You get down to $400 billion, what happens? All of the machine starts going, and they're ratcheting it back up, usually in the name of defense, and now we're at $1 trillion again. Republicans will go in and say, well, gosh, we got to have some more planes and more bullets and make sure our men and women have the tools they need. Well, you know what? I agree. But let's sacrifice then. If you're going to have to raise and spend some more money for defense, where are you going to go cut it? Well, we don't want to do that. Okay. Well, where are you going to get the money? magic money tree? Or is it going to be the, you know, hanging around the necks of all of you and all of your kids, right? That's the question. If we had to sit down with $3.5 trillion and say, Social Security is going to be bankrupt in 8 years, Medicare is going to be bankrupt in 8 years, what are we going to do to fix it? Oh, well, I guess we better go cut the NEA. Oh, no, we can't cut the NEA. A liberal will say, okay, great. Well, you're going to cut Social Security? Well, no, we can't cut Social Security. Okay, what about defense over here? We're asking people to go deal with Iran, deal with Afghanistan, Syria. We're dealing with threats around the world. We're trying to fight and make sure that the Chinese and Russians don't surpass us in our technology. Are you going to cut that? Well, no, I don't want to cut that. Are you going to raise taxes? Well, no, we're not going to do that. Welcome to $1 trillion deficits and then nobody coming together, because why? Each side goes to each corner and they just say, we want this, and then they both just spend everything and do everything and they never have to fight and figure out and come together and make tough decisions. When the founders founded the country, how long did they sit in the room at Independence Hall in Philadelphia to figure out how to form the country? Months on end, right? It didn't just go in for a couple days. Somebody drafts some stuff, put it on the floor and say, vote up or down, and they walk home. Right? They fought over it, figured it out. They argued. They yelled at each other. They stayed up all night and they sat there and then they figured out how to come to a consensus. The Voting Rights Act was on the floor of the Senate in 1965 for 4 months, 3 or 4 months. You can fact check me on that. But a long time. Today, it would be pre-cooked in the room by some group of party elders. They would come down to the floor and they'd say, vote on it. And then there would be dissension across Democrats and Republicans, and it would either not pass or it would pass in a poor form, because we're not debating and having open votes and amendments. This was the second reason why I demanded the yays and nays last week. And let me tell you one interesting story about that. I'm sorry, it's a long question answer. One of my colleagues came up and sat next to me the other night, for seat next to me 2 nights ago. And he goes, you know what, Chip? I didn't agree with you when you first did this. I wasn't sure how that strategy would play out. He's a good guy, he's from Louisiana. And then he said, you know what happened? We've had more good debate over the last 2 or 3 days of these late night votes than I've had in a long time. We were sitting in the back bench and we were sitting there. We had to go through 70 amendments. And you're sitting there and going through 2 minute votes on amendments. So suddenly you're asking all your colleagues, well, wait, how are you voting on that? Well, how are you voting on that? Okay, my staff said vote this way. I've looked at the bill and I think it's this. And you're having this robust discussion. It was the most engaging we've had in a long time. I think we should just vote. Go to the floor, offer amendments. What are people afraid of? Shirts and skins, that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of some accountability in an election cycle. If my voters don't like the way I vote, they've got a choice. Click the other button. That's okay.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name's Elijah from Long Beach, and in high school, universal basic income was shown with a very positive light, mm-hmm. and it sounded like a great idea, but it also borders on socialism. What is your opinion on this idea that is being spread?
Borders on socialism?
Well,
universal basic income, where it has been tried, it has largely failed. And in fact, there was an interesting study recently. I'm going to mess up which Scandinavian country it was, but one of those Scandinavian countries, I think, had a universal basic income, and then they started having this problem. This problem was they were having trouble getting people to work. Who knew, right? Who knew that if you just said, oh, well, you're going to get whatever certain baseline amount of money if you do nothing, that people would choose to do nothing, right? That's the problem. Like, This is the, I think, essence of the question of our day. You all have to want to embrace the uncertainty of freedom and capitalism, because it is awesome. It moves more people up income levels. It moves more people from poverty to wealth. My great-grandfather lost the farm in the Depression, worked as a janitor in the local church for the remaining 30 years of his life. It was noble and it was okay. His daughter, my grandmother, lost my grandfather, her husband, to cancer. My dad, her son, had polio, 1949. So there she was, a single mom in West Texas in 1949, raising my polio-stricken father and my then two-year-old uncle. And she ran and became the first woman elected county clerk in a small town in West Texas. And then she worked hard, and then my dad was the first to go to college. And then dad sacrificed and worked hard, never complained a bit, and then sent me to a good college. And then I was the first to go to graduate school. Now, we're not wealthy by any sort of American standards of wealth, but talk about first world problems, because we're all wealthy in the history of the world. This is what the Great American Experiment has done. That story I just told, every one of you can tell that story. Every one of you has a grandparent who sacrificed, a parent who sacrificed so that your life is better, so your parents' life was better. That's the American story. I don't want to hear any of this crap about universal basic income. It doesn't work. Government doesn't provide the solution. Government is the problem. And we should remember that.
Thank you.
I think I'm getting the hook. It's the last question.
Last question comes from one of our virtual pass attendees. Kelly from Mississippi wants to know why so many members of Congress go back on their campaign promises. Is it a lack of care or a lack of ability to deliver?
Wow. So kind of filibuster this one for another 20 minutes? Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. Well, it is a great question. It's a great question to end on, actually. I always, when I was campaigning last year, it was the first time I'd ever campaigned. I've worked on some campaigns, but it was the first time I'd ever run. You got to figure it out as you go. I would often differentiate between that complaint you often hear about that question, right? Why do so many politicians campaign on one thing and then do something different when they get to Washington? I'm not actually bothered by that as much. I mean, I'm bothered by it, by as much as how many politicians will tell you one thing literally at the moment they're doing the other. That's the bigger problem. That's the actual difficulty, and it's the thing that's frustrating the establishment today is Twitter and social media and the ability to get information out in real time about what's happening in Washington is making it harder for politicians to do something that is directly conflicting with what they campaigned on or what they say, more importantly, when they go home. I think that the reason they do that is because it's hard to stick to what you say and what you campaign on. And I actually blame Reagan. And that's a weird thing to say to close this out. Reagan made conservatism a popular thing. Before Reagan, there was a big movement away from that. He brought it back. And he made conservatism something people wanted to say. And now virtually all Republicans, save a few, run as a conservative. Hint, they're not. But they run as a conservative because they know they need to run as a conservative because so many people believe in the great things that happen under conservative, limited government constitutional principles. So our job as citizens is to hold those jokers, I'm going to use third party in this case, accountable. I want to be held accountable. I want people to look at my voting record and say, I disagree with that, I want to do this. I think that, at the end of the day, is the core question. And so that question to me is the most important one, more than doing something different than you campaigned on. It's don't look at the American people and tell them that you're doing something like securing the border when you're definitively not. Don't tell them that you're balancing the budget and limiting spending when you're blowing caps. Don't tell them you're a fiscal conservative when you're busting caps. Don't tell them you're for healthcare freedom when you're picking solutions that are increasing government involvement in healthcare. Don't tell them that you want to bring the guys home when you're pushing our men and women in uniform into yet another battle and asking them to go on their seventh, eighth, or ninth tours of duty. Look at the American people and tell them what you're doing and own it and be proud to own it. When I voted to say that we shouldn't have our men and women in Yemen, I'll own that. I think we need to pump the brakes a little bit while we hold our enemies accountable. When I voted to say that we shouldn't have automatic back pay for federal workers when the shutdown was going on, I'll own that. You know why? Because it's a get out of jail free card for members of Congress to be able to go get on their planes, fly home, and not actually deal with a government shutdown and actually fund the government. That's actually what happens. Own it and go back and tell your people what you're doing. You are the future of the country. Thank you for spending time being here. I was joking about not being at the College World Series. That's where I would have been when I was 15 or 16, I can tell you. You guys are making a good choice. Keep following this path, because the future of the country depends on your all being engaged and do it. Thank you for coming here, and thank you for listening to me for a little bit. Thank you.